Our featured story, we're talking all about this imminent confrontation with Iran. And the latest is that earlier today, there was a second round of negotiations between the United States and Iran, second round this year. About a week and a half ago, the U.S. and Iran met in Oman, and this is in the middle of a massive U.S. military buildup in the Middle East. Trump has given Iran an ultimatum, and the ultimatum is surrender or die. Either they capitulate to our demands, or we are going to war with Iran. Trump has said repeatedly he is looking for a decisive military option. Translation, regime change. The ultimatum is either Iran is going to accept all of our conditions on nuclear, as well as Israel's conditions on nuclear missiles and proxies, or else we are in another regime change war in the Middle East. So there's a huge military buildup. It is a loaded gun pointed at Iran. And as this is happening, the United States has engaged Iran in a last-ditch effort to reach some kind of compromise, some kind of deal. To that end, they met about a week and a half ago in Oman, and a framework was created for negotiations. And as we've talked about, that framework simply means Iran needs assurances that we're only looking for compromise on the nuclear file. They don't want to talk about missiles. They don't want to talk about proxies. They only want to talk about nuclear. Today, the Iranians met with the United States in Switzerland, and they actually got down to brass tacks about what this deal might look like. And the big news is that Iran has apparently given some concessions. And that concession is that they have agreed that they might give up enrichment for 3 years and that they will forfeit their stockpile of highly enriched uranium to a third country like Russia or another ally of theirs. And that is said to be the jumping off point for future negotiations. Now, this is a story. This is from the Wall Street Journal. We'll read through this and then we'll talk a little bit about what we can expect here. It says, quote, U.S. and Iranian officials said that Tuesday's nuclear talks in Geneva made progress following Tehran's willingness to compromise around the edges of its nuclear program, including moving its near weapons-grade uranium offshore. As the negotiations resumed, Iran sent a veiled threat carrying out military exercises in the Strait of Hormuz. The question remains whether the proposal and threat will move President Trump. Iranian Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei warned in a speech on Tuesday ahead of the talks that Iran was prepared to retaliate against any American strike. Until Tuesday, much of the diplomacy had focused on talking about the scope of negotiations. That's that framework I keep mentioning, what the negotiations will be about, what's on the table. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said that Tuesday's talks were more substantive, however, and that both sides in Geneva presented ideas aimed at crafting an agreement. He said Iran and the U.S. agreed to exchange texts to create the framework for a deal before a date for new negotiations is decided. However, a U.S. official gave a more circumspect readout from the negotiations, which took place at the Omani ambassador's residence on the shore of Lake Geneva. That official said, quote, progress was made, but there are still a lot of details to discuss. That official placed the onus on Tehran for taking the next steps, saying the Iranians agreed to come back within 2 weeks to address some of the open gaps in our positions. And what that means is the United States is not coming off of its demands. And we'll talk specifically about what that means, but this official, speaking on behalf of the White House, is saying, we're not budging. So we met last week to talk about what's on the table and the scope of these talks. We met this morning to come up with some ideas about an agreement to craft maybe some creative solution. Iran has come down. They're making some concessions. The U.S. official is saying, yeah, well, they got about 2 weeks to agree to what we want. They have 2 weeks to close the gap. Here's what we want. Iran is over here. We're going to give them 2 weeks to find their way over to our position. But that it's very clear from what the U.S. government is saying that this is not really a negotiation. This is an ultimatum. And to the extent that they are meeting who knows what the real purpose of this is? Maybe it's building rapport. Maybe it's just communicating the message. But it seems that the White House is being very clear that this is a surrender or die situation. Either Iran is going to agree to everything we're demanding, or it's going to be a war. And that's really it. It doesn't sound like there's a lot of wiggle room here. But like I said, more on that in a moment. The article goes on. It says at the previous meeting in Oman, Iran told the U.S. it was open to sending that highly enriched material, which would be enough to fuel 12 nuclear bombs abroad, possibly to Russia. Iranian officials have signaled in conversations with other diplomats that they might offer to pause uranium enrichment for up to 3 years, according to diplomats. That promise, however, wouldn't change much. Iran is believed to have stopped enriching uranium after U.S. strikes last June, and it also falls short of U.S. demands that it halt enrichment altogether. Some regional diplomats are thinking bigger and pushing a multi-point plan that includes everything from non-aggression commitments to business deals. The White House is also under pressure from Israel to constrain Iran's ballistic missile program. Israeli PM Benjamin Netanyahu, who met Trump last week, said Sunday a good deal would require the dismantling of Iran's nuclear infrastructure and limiting the range of its ballistic missiles. The Pentagon last week redeployed the Navy's most advanced aircraft carrier, the USS Gerald Ford, from the Caribbean and sent it toward the Middle East. It actually just entered the Atlantic earlier today from the Caribbean. It will join another aircraft carrier, the USS Abraham Lincoln, and a host of other U.S. warships, warplanes, and air defense systems across the region. On Sunday, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said expectations for a deal weren't high. He said, no one has ever been able to do a successful deal with Iran, but we're going to try. So once again, we find ourselves in exactly the same position that we have been in for 8 years, actually. Okay. And we can talk once again about the fundamental dynamics here. Israel, since 1979, has been pursuing the overthrow of the Iranian regime. That is their endgame. And it is very important to understand this. Israel does not care about nuclear weapons at all, not in and of themselves. The reason that Israel hates nuclear weapons is because nuclear weapons protect countries from Israel. So this is why in 1981, Israel bombed Iraq, because Iraq was developing a nuclear arsenal. This is why Israel bombed Syria in 2007, because they feared that Syria was developing a nuclear arsenal. Why did they drop the bombs? Why did they carry out the strikes? Because Israel had already wanted to destroy those regimes, and a nuclear arsenal would deter them from doing this. So it's no coincidence that after 1981, Iraq was defenseless when the U.S. invaded in 1990 and then again in 2003. It's no coincidence that after Israel bombed Syria in 2007, soon after in 2011, Syria underwent a civil war and the U.S., Israel, and other countries backed proxies that overthrew Syria's government. Here we are again. 2025, Iran's nuclear program is attacked. What do you think happens after that? So Israel is seeking the destruction of Iran's regime. Iran knows this. So to defend itself, Iran is hedging its bets by creating a latent nuclear arsenal. They have the ability to create nuclear fuel for a bomb, but they haven't made enough. They haven't enriched it to the point that it could be used in a bomb, and they haven't made the bomb. That's also why they have ballistic missiles, because ballistic missiles are uninterceptable in enough numbers and at certain speeds. And that is a conventional way to deter Israel, just like how North Korea has artillery lined up and pointed at Seoul in the same way that they have a nuclear program also. And Iran has its proxies. If Iran doesn't make it, if they get nuked by Israel and the United States, then the proxies could carry out the retaliation. Such is the underlying dynamic in the Middle East. And now that Iraq has been defeated, now that Syria has been defeated, the only rival left for Israel, maybe not the only, but the next in a long line, is Iran. Israel wants to destroy Iran, but Iran has this nuclear capability. And again, let's be clear about what that capability is. They have the ability to enrich uranium. They have centrifuges. Centrifuges enrich uranium. And if they have this native ability, if enrichment is happening in centrifuges that are inside of Iranian territory, and if those centrifuges are fortified underground and inside mountains, then theoretically, on a certain timeline, Iran could create nuclear fuel for a bomb, and then they can make a bomb. And this is really the subject of the negotiations. Now, here comes the United States. And the United States does not want Iran to have a bomb. We don't necessarily have a problem with them having a peaceful nuclear program, having reactors. But to fuel a reactor, you don't necessarily need the centrifuges. You don't need that native ability to make enriched uranium. You just need to be able to import it from another country. So this is why the United States is preoccupied with having Iran limit its enrichment activity to a very low level, or, and I think this is the demand now, to take away their enrichment ability. And we'll let them have enriched uranium, but only at a low level, and we can't let them enrich it any further. So you can have your centrifuges in another country's territory so we can shut it down and we can watch it and have oversight over it. And we can prevent you from getting more material or enriching material beyond a safe limit. That's where we stand. Now, at a certain point, Iran began enriching uranium to a level that can be used in a bomb. Now they have a big stockpile of that also. This is at the center of our strategic dynamic with Iran. We want to take their enrichment ability or put a ton of restrictions on it, and we want to seize that stockpile of already highly enriched uranium, which they could take and with very little effort turn it into material for a bomb. That's what we are concerned with as the United States. Now, last year, we negotiated with the Iranians, and we said we want to come up with a framework for a deal where, again, we take away that enrichment ability and we take away the stockpile. And for Iran, this is a red line. They will not give up enrichment. They will not give up their stockpile of enriched material. So in the middle of the negotiations, Israel started bombing Iran. Then the United States went in and we bombed their centrifuges. How did this change things? Well, by bombing their centrifuges, it made it so that effectively they can't enrich anymore. For them to be able to enrich again, they will have to rebuild. Now they have the expertise. They have the infrastructure. They have the blueprints. On a long enough timeline, they will rebuild the centrifuges and they will be able to enrich again. But by bombing the centrifuges, we may have set them back by years. So we have effectively stopped them from doing this. At the same time, that stockpile of highly enriched uranium, we don't know where it is, but we suspect that it is in the same place as those destroyed centrifuges and probably inaccessible. So they probably can't use the stockpile, although we're not certain, and they probably can't enrich because although they say they have undeclared, more primitive centrifuges elsewhere, their most advanced and modern ones are buried under rubble. And it will take time for them to be able to further enrich their stockpile, access the stockpile, and again, for them to rebuild those centrifuges. Now, why is this relevant? So we return to these negotiations a year later. All of this played out in 2025. We negotiated with Iran for 60 days, and this was the impasse. For Iran, the red line was, we will not give up enrichment. We're not going to give up our stockpile. And for the United States, we said, you have to give up enrichment. It can't happen inside your territory, and you have to turn over the stockpile. Couldn't come to an agreement. Israel forced our hand, and we wound up bombing them. Well, here we are now a year later. And once again, the United States is building up its force posture in the Middle East. We've got now two aircraft carriers on the way, a massive amount of aircraft, like actually a worrying amount of strategic aircraft and strike aircraft and fighter jets. And and we've got a lot of naval ships. We got a lot of stuff over there. And once again, we are telling Iran, you're going to give up enrichment, you're going to give up the stockpile, or else it's a war. Now, the development today in these negotiations is that Iran is apparently making concessions. As I just read out in this article, Iran is willing to turn over the stockpile to a third-party country. They'll give Russia that highly enriched uranium, and they're agreeing not to enrich for 3 years. Well, why is this not really an actual concession? Because they probably can't enrich for the next 3 years anyway. Now, we don't know that for sure. Iran claims that their centrifuges were not completely destroyed. They claim that they have undeclared centrifuges elsewhere. And again, they're not as sophisticated. They're not as advanced. They say this. We don't really know that for sure. But they certainly cannot enrich to the extent that they were before, at the rate that they were before, anytime in the near future. And they probably can't even access the highly enriched uranium either and further enrich it. If they could enrich and if they could access that material, then it actually would be fairly easy for them to make weapons-grade uranium and then make a bomb. We're not sure about this information, though. The point is, these concessions that Iran is making, they're not real concessions. We're promising not to do the thing that we can't really do. We're promising that we won't do this thing for the next 3 years that we probably couldn't do anyway for the next 3 years. We're going to give up our stockpile of enriched uranium that we probably can't do anything with anyway. In exchange, they want massive sanctions relief. They want business deals. They want to get back in the game. They want to get integrated into the regional economy. More than anything, they want to buy time. Because the more time between now and the next confrontation, that means they can build 300 more missiles per month. So even if it takes them, even if it buys them 6 months, that's 1,800 more ballistic missiles they can throw at Israel. And they can rebuild their centrifuges and rebuild their nuclear complex. And who knows, maybe they could even further enrich uranium that is undeclared. So Iran is in the business of buying time. They're not serious. They're not serious negotiators. And even if that was a real concession, it's still not what the United States is looking for. The U.S. is demanding that there is no enrichment on Iranian soil. Not that they're going to voluntarily restrain themselves for a short period of time that sunsets. The U.S. says you cannot have the infrastructure. You cannot have the ability to do this. And that's really the sticking point. And fundamentally, Iran has never showed willingness to negotiate on this part. Iran says it is their right as a nation. Iran says it is the pride of their nation that they have developed this capability. And the reason they're so insistent upon this is because they don't trust us. They don't trust that we're even able to execute an independent foreign policy. They know that if they give up enrichment, if they give up this nuclear hedge, that within 10 years, Israel is going to foment a civil war in their country, and they're going down. And the only thing that is protecting them is that they have all this nuclear material. And that is why it is in the best interest of the United States that Iran does not collapse. That is why it is actually in the strategic interest of the United States not to get into a war with Iran in the event that Iran develops a primitive nuclear device and then, God forbid, uses it as the ultimate deterrent. So that is the impasse, and nothing has changed. Now, on the side of the United States, as we talked about, this official and Marco Rubio and the other negotiators, Donald Trump himself, they are saying, look, we're not actually here to compromise. We're not here to negotiate. These are our demands. And our demands are you can't enrich and you can't have the stockpile. And you can take your concessions and you can blow them out your ass. If you don't agree, then we're going to war. And it really seems to be that simple. And the reason the United States is saying this is because if Iran has enrichment, you actually have to rewind even a little bit further. It's sort of funny. Rubio says that no one has ever been able to make a deal with Iran. That's not true. Barack Obama and John Kerry made a deal with Iran in 2015. There was an Iranian nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in 2015. And what that deal did is it restricted Iran's enrichment for 10 years. And there was oversight and regular inspections and 24/7 cameras. And there were sanctions relief attached to compliance with those restrictions. That was a successful deal, and it was working. Iran was abiding by it. Iran was certified by the IAEA, by America. We were doing our part. The EU was doing their part. The deal was going along for 3 years until Trump pulled us out of the deal. And Trump pulled us out of the deal in 2018 unilaterally at the behest of Israel. And the reason that Trump pulled us out of that deal is because he said, we cannot have a nuclear deal that sunsets. He said, as long as the JCPOA expires in 2025, which it did in September, he said, as long as the deal expires, well, then Iran can just simply resume unrestricted enrichment. He said, if the deal sunsets after 10 years, well, those restrictions are lifted. And then it doesn't matter what the deal says. And then we're in the same boat that we were before. So why is this relevant? Why does this matter? It matters because this administration in particular, Trump himself as a man, he cannot accept anything less than no enrichment capability. Why? Because if he accepts anything less, then this deal is just as good or as bad as the JCPOA. You see the psychology? So Trump goes in 2018 and says, this deal isn't good enough. I could get a better deal. This deal is too soft. What did that deal say? That deal said you can keep enrichment under certain limits for a certain amount of time. Now, here we are 8 years later. If Trump comes back and gets an identical deal, which is we're going to limit enrichment in exchange for sanctions relief and it sunsets in a certain amount of time, well, then what does that say? It says you're a failure. It says the past 8 years were in vain. What was it all for? We had this exact agreement in place. Arguably, it was a better deal. Now, here we are on the other side of your second term, and you're going to get a 3-year commitment with restrictions on enrichment, and you're going to give a ton of sanctions relief and business deals and investment. It's as bad or worse than the JCPOA. Trump will never go for it. Now, what is the better deal? And what was the impetus behind ripping up the first deal? The better deal is that Iran cannot enrich at all. No sunset, no time limit, no voluntary restraint. It is that we oversee the destruction of Iran's centrifuges. This just so happens to be also what Israel wants. This is what Netanyahu wants. This is what the Adelsons want. And why do they insist upon that in particular? Because they want to destroy Iran. And they cannot, with any confidence, destroy Iran if Iran still has centrifuges. If there is any doubt or any concern that Iran has some centrifuges left and they're enriching and they're going to make material for a bomb, then Israel cannot confidently bring us into a war where Iran might have a nuclear deterrent, where they might credibly develop a nuclear arsenal. That's the position that we are in. And it's just like it was last year. It's not just a negotiation between these two parties of the United States and Iran. I'm getting ahead of myself. It's a 3-party negotiation between the United States, Iran, and Israel. And so other people have pointed this out. It's sort of interesting. A deal between the United States and Iran is eminently possible. It actually would be relatively easy. Iran is not our enemy. And actually, Iran has been integrating into the region. They have made peace with Saudi Arabia. They have made peace with Egypt. They are making peace with Turkey. They are making peace with all these countries. We could theoretically normalize ties with Iran, and Iran could be normalized in the community of nations. And maybe they'd even be willing to do things they otherwise would not be willing to do. But the complicating factor in all of this, the big wrinkle, of course, is that Israel is insistent that Iran render itself defenseless without a nuclear hedge, and taking it further, without missiles, without proxies. And these are things that Iran doesn't even want to talk about. These are things that Iran says are not even on the table. They're not even going to go there. So with all that in mind, it is almost an inevitability that there is not going to be a deal. Can be no compromise. These are irreconcilable positions. You cannot simultaneously have enrichment and not have enrichment. And if there's no deal, what do you get? You get a war. And this is why I say war is almost certainly where we are headed. The question now that is upon us is just what kind of war it's going to be. I don't think there's any question that there's going to be a U.S. confrontation with Iran imminently. I don't know about this week. I don't know about next week. They're telling Iran, you got 2 weeks to come to the table. You look at the force posture in the Middle East, it just looks too big and too expensive for it to be a bluff. It's too much for it to be brinksmanship. And who knows, maybe that's the point. But it looks like we've got this loaded gun pointed at Iran. You've got two aircraft carrier strike groups. You've got dozens and dozens of aircraft and aircraft squadrons. You've got the U.S. Army on notice that they're going to deploy soon, like maybe within a few weeks. The question that is now before us is, what does an engagement or a confrontation look like with Iran? Because the problem is, we rely on air power. We bombed Iran with airstrikes last year. We went in there in 2025. We hit Fordo. We hit Natanz. We hit Esfahan. We dropped the bunker buster bombs. And this was after Israel had pounded Iran for weeks, literally thousands of times. If we're serious about a decisive confrontation with the Iranian regime, it's going to require a lot more than air power. You can't bomb your way out of this. You can't drop enough bombs. This is a country of 90 million people. They got a million-man army. They've got ballistic missiles, probably thousands of them. They've got proxies in almost every Middle Eastern country. This is not a war that you're going to win by doing a few airstrikes. Not like last year, not even like what we did in Syria. If you want a decisive confrontation with Iran, you need some kind of a ground force. And that either means you're going to have the protesters take to the streets and then armed militia, separatist, outside groups, or you're going to need some kind of U.S. invasion force. Anything less than that, it's not going to be decisive. It's not going to be a true decapitation. And so that's really the question. Now we're in this bind where we can't win the negotiation. We have to go to war. Well, we can't win the war without a ground force, but that also seems unthinkable. And so it seems like maybe in the end, we're going to get perhaps waves of airstrikes that will degrade Iran's defenses. And what we will be engaged in is a protracted multi-year engagement, just like what happened in Syria, where you've got sponsorship of groups inside the country, where you've got basically an open front in the air inside of Iran, waves of airstrikes degrading Iran's air defenses, degrading its internal security, degrading its military and leadership. And this happens over a long period of time. I don't think it's going to be a full-scale ground invasion. It's not going to be a major ground war. At least, never say never. I mean, I don't know that that's going to happen right away, but I think what you're going to see maybe most likely is it is going to be a successive wave of airstrikes on Iran. And this is going to become part of maybe I don't want to say a longer term, but it's going to be a protracted military campaign in Iran to continually degrade Iran's defenses, degrade their political leadership, their military. And in a sense, it's playing this game. Iran is left to its own devices, building missiles, rebuilding their nuclear program. They're rearming their proxies. And the way to think about it is that Israel comes in, degrades everything. The United States does a decisive strike. Iran tries to bring it back. Before they can bring it back to the previous levels, we hit them again. And it seems as though we're going to be trapped in this cycle until either there's going to be a major ground war or eventually the Iranian regime collapses from the inside. But I'll tell you what's not going to happen. What seems to me at this point to be the least likely option is that Iran is left alone. You have to understand the calculus here. And the reason that I was able to predict last year that we would be in this position this year is because I was thinking in this way. And I'll tell you precisely what I said in June of 2025. After Israel and the United States bombed Iran, Iran booted all the IAEA inspectors. After that happened, Iran refused to negotiate with the United States and even with the European Union. They said, we can't trust the U.S. If we can't trust the U.S., we can't even trust Europe. So actually, a deal became less likely after those strikes because the rapport was weakened. And not only that, but Iran fully extricated themselves from any kind of enforcement mechanism with regard to their nuclear program. So what happens after Iran refuses negotiation, refuses inspections? Well, we have to assume, and I think correctly so, that Iran is now preparing for war. They see the writing on the wall. They know that Trump is president. They see that Netanyahu is holding on to power. And they see the power that Israel has over the United States. And so they know that that strike last year was not a one and done. So what are they doing? They start rebuilding. They start building their missiles back. They start building their nuclear program back because they were just attacked. And so they're rebuilding their defenses naturally. Once bitten, right? They're building it all back. They're trying to fortify for the next negotiation, for the next confrontation. Iran is built like a fortress and they're rebuilding themselves. Now we're watching this. The U.S. and Israel are watching Iran build its missile arsenal back, building its nuclear program back. The longer that we wait between the first strike and the second strike, it's like a mathematical function. Every month after that initial strike, Iran is going to have more missiles. With each passing month, they will have a bigger missile arsenal than they did the month before. And all those missiles are aimed at Israel. And though with every missile that is aimed at Israel, Iran increases its leverage. It's more billions in the hands of Hezbollah to rebuild. It's more missiles pointed at Israel. It's more centrifuges put back online, maybe more enrichment, more uranium. Now, if you understand that this is happening, then what kind of pressure does that put on Washington and Tel Aviv? It means that we either need to make a deal or hit him again fast, because the longer that we wait, the worse the problem becomes. Again, this is in terms of strategic thinking. The more leverage Iran has to either hold out on a deal or to preemptively strike us or Israel or to hold out in a protracted conflict. So it actually puts pressure on us to quickly resolve the problem. Again, either through a deal or a war. And again, a deal became less likely. A deal is still impossible. If Iran won't come to the table, there's really only one other way this can go. And it's not like we're going to go to war eventually in 10 years, in 20 years, when we work up the political will. We don't have that kind of dynamic right now. Every month that goes by, according to Wall Street Journal and the Rupert Murdoch-owned Zionist media empire, according to Grassi at the IAEA, they're closer to the bomb. They got 300 more missiles every single month. So we have to act quickly is the mentality. That's the mindset. And here's, like I said, what's not going to happen. Israel in particular, but the U.S. and Israel in general, they're not going to let Israel go on indefinitely and in perpetuity amassing a larger arsenal, number one. And number two, what they're definitely not going to let happen is a nuclear deal where Iran gets sanctions relief. Because Iran gets sanctions relief, they rebuild their economy, and then they're never going anywhere, because what is the number one threat to the Iranian regime? It is the prospect that there will be an uprising from inside the country. That is fueled by economic insecurity. Why were there protests in January? Well, they were astroturfed, but they were amplified and exacerbated by the economic conditions. The collapse of the currency, runs on the banks, infrastructure problems, rolling brownouts, loss of running water, electricity, other critical infrastructure. And so, in other words, if Iran, let's say they make a deal, let's say they go on without a deal, well, that gives them time to fix their internal problems, rebuild their defenses, and then they're not going anywhere. Then they become impossible to dislodge. And as we talked about from the very beginning, if Israel's strategic imperative is regime change in Iran, that's the last thing that they want. And that is the only thing that you need to understand, is that Israel will not tolerate a deal. It's not that they don't want one. It's not that that Iran won't agree to one. The only thing you need to understand is that Israel cannot accept one. They literally cannot tolerate a deal. It is an imperative that they sabotage any deal. And as long as the United States is involved with Israel, that is exactly what is going to happen. Israel is working against our interest here, and we have no control over them. And to the extent that that is the case, we are never going to have peace with Iran. There's only one way this is ever going to end. And a lot of people have a hard time imagining that and how that's going to work and everything. But all you need to do is fill in the blanks here. All you need to do is understand these underlying dynamics, and it is inevitable where it has to go. Like I said, and the reason I phrase it that way, it sounds extraordinary that we would go to war with Iran. It sounds unbelievable that we would have ground troops there. That sounds crazy to me. It sounds far-fetched. What is less likely is that Israel will tolerate an Iran that is normalized in the international community. What is less likely is that Israel will tolerate Iran rebuilding all of its defenses, rebuilding Hezbollah, building more missiles, God forbid, getting a nuclear bomb. They're not going to let it happen. So this is what you're in for. And it's like I said at the top of the show about Republicans, this was always going to be the case. Ever since Nikki Haley went to Israel, when was that? May of 2025? When Nikki Haley dropped out of the Republican primary last year, she took a trip to Israel, and she said she was doing it on behalf of Donald Trump. And she said she was endorsing Donald Trump in Israel. And it was reported that that was brokered. Miriam Adelson pledged $100 million. Nikki dropped out of the race, threw her support behind Trump. And the price tag was this: West Bank, Gaza Strip, Iran. That was the price tag. It was obvious from the beginning. And I don't know how Republicans are shameless enough to even bother asking for us to vote again when this is what we get. You know, once again, I did this. Think about when Trump ran in 2016, when he started his campaign in 2015, when he got up on that debate stage for the first time, the big line was that he was against the war in Iraq. Wasn't that the whole point? Do you even remember 10, 11 years ago when Trump ran the first campaign, the Iraq war was one of the biggest issues. Trump ran against Jeb Bush and made Jeb Bush a target because his brother started the war in Iraq. And Trump was railing it. We should have never been there. They lied about weapons of mass destruction. We don't even have it. Now ISIS is taking over. That was the whole point, was to get us out of Iraq, out of Syria. Look at how far we've come. Think about it. It would have been unthinkable that we would go to war in Iran 10 years ago. It was unthinkable we would even stay in Iraq. And now here we are in February 2026, and we have an armada in the Middle East. We have our entire army over there ready to start another Middle East regime change war over weapons of mass destruction that don't exist. And they want us to vote in the midterms. We need to get back on track, they say. Get back on track. You've lost the track. You have lost the plot completely. And you should be embarrassed for even asking for a vote. And they want us then to go out for Rubio and Vance. Who do you think is the architect of this? Vance was talking about bombing Iran before he even got the nomination to be the vice president in 2024. And people say he should be the guy. I just need to impress upon you how shameless they are in asking. And you should really understand who these people are. You should understand the gravity of all of this. Coming to you in 2026, we need to get back on track. We need your vote in the midterms. We got to get J.D. Vance in 28. Vance, Rubio, they're in on this. They're part of this. A war with Iran. It's like, it's almost unthinkable. Because war with Iran was like synonymous with everything that the Jews wanted. If you were to say, like, what policy comes to mind when you think of Israel's agenda? What policy comes to mind when you think of like a Jew first, Israel first agenda? You would say war with Iran. You would say that Netanyahu and Ben Shapiro's literal wet dream, like their sexual fantasy, is U.S. going to war with Iran. And the whole reason people voted for Trump the first time is because he was the last guy who would make that mistake. He was the last guy who was going to do that because he was against the war in Iraq from the beginning. And he torched Jeb Bush on that basis. Well, it's been a long time since 2015, hasn't it been? And MAGA is just means nothing now. It's whatever he wants it to mean. It's putting up stupid plaques in the Rose Garden. It's all this ridiculous nonsense they're putting on True Social every day. There was a time when MAGA meant we're not going to war in Iran. We're going to put America first. It meant we're going to build a wall, deport every illegal. We're going to put tariffs on foreign goods, rebuild factories. Now it's like we're just going to give AI everything they want. We're going to give Silicon Valley everything they want, all the labor, all the students. We're going to go to war with Iran. We want a $1 trillion military. We're not going to build a wall. We're not going to bother deporting anybody if they work for a corporation. Total betrayal. So we'll see. Within 2 weeks, the U.S. is expecting capitulation from Iran. If they don't get it, I think they're already drafting the damage control plan. How are they going to sell this one? They're already getting ready.